From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up,
I think we're going to have great support from both sides of Congress. And I really believe that Congress is going to work very hard on the DACA agreement and come up with something.
But Congress has failed to pass immigration reform for at least the past 15 years. We'll look back on that history for lessons on where immigration reform might go next. Plus, Kurt Anderson on what makes America truly exceptional. Its centuries-long resistance to truth, from ancient witch trials to modern digital delusions.
With the internet, every faction of reality and pseudo-truth could have its own websites, news feeds, everything.
Right. Also today in sports, the Red Sox and Apple Watch Gate. Plus, at age 37 and battling Sjogren's syndrome, Venus Williams continues to amaze. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Trump's DACA decision yesterday has put the onus on Congress now. Pass immigration reform, that Trump effectively said, if you don't like the idea of threatening young so-called dreamers with deportation. Here's the president this afternoon on Air Force One.
I'd like to see something where we have good border security and we have a great DACA transaction where everybody is happy and now they don't have to worry about it anymore.
Well, DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, is just one part of the long debate over immigration reform. But now that the president has so thoroughly punted to Congress, we wanted to take a look back at the long history of fitful immigration legislation in this country to gauge whether immigration reform has any better chance of passing now. Susan Davis is a congressional reporter for NPR, and she's covered Congress, elections, and national politics since 2002, and she joins us. Susan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So if we could, let's march sort of backwards in time here a little bit. And I just wanted to start with the sort of most recent attempt that Congress made at immigration reform. I mean, it went from roughly May 2012, when President Obama said he was hopeful that some sort of immigration legislation could pass because it was a bipartisan issue, to, what was it, June 2014, when Representative Luis Gutierrez declared immigration reform dead on Capitol Hill. So what happened?
Well, there's been a long fight on this, particularly it depends on which iteration of immigration reform we're talking about. In the short term right now, we're now talking about the DREAM Act, which specifically targeted the children of those brought here. Children and people who were brought to this country and by through no choice of their own. So the first iteration of that DREAM Act was introduced in 2001. So the proposal has existed in Congress for 16 years. Mm-hmm. And as you noted, there has been moments in the course of those 16 years where Congress came pretty close. And that most recent time, as you referenced, was after the Senate did actually pass a comprehensive immigration piece of legislation that would have created a path to citizenship, not just for those children, but for their parents as well. And that legislation was derailed, as most immigration efforts have been, by politics.
Right.
Shortly after the Senate had passed that bill, if you remember, then House Majority Leader Eric Cantor was defeated in a primary. It was a historic loss, and it was politically interpreted as the Republican Party rebelling against this idea of passing comprehensive immigration. And his loss effectively killed immigration in Congress. And there hasn't really been a sincere revival of that effort since then. We're seeing it now.
So that was those historic 2014 midterms, right? And I mean, Republican House leadership up until that time had been operating under the assumption that they would get through that election cycle and then take care of immigration reform. But we had the rise of right-wing Republicans that were immigration reform skeptics. I mean, what was their pushback to the proposals that were on the table?
That's a really good point, because I always think it's worth reminding people that historically the Republican Party has been for this kind of immigration reform. I kind of describe it as the split, and I think we saw that split intensify after the 2010 elections and the rise of sort of the shorthand, we call it the Tea Party movement, and a division within the Republican Party between a more nativist or nationalist view, which I think was perfectly captured by the Trump campaign in 2016, in a more, I call it Chamber of Commerce Republicans for short, sort of the business allies of the traditional allies of the Republican Party, who have always been in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. And there is a philosophical split there between those who see immigration as an economic boon, as something that is good for the country, both in the short and long term, and those who see it, I think that has been articulated by the president at times, by his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, as an economic threat. That it is about taking jobs away, that it is about a net negative for American citizens. And that philosophical clash is very real. Now we have a moment where we have a president who, even though he campaigned on a lot of those ideas, is philosophically flexible. And I think that that was proven again this week in the way he spoke about DACA and these and Dreamers, as they're often called. And you know, at the one hand, he's ending this program and threatening to end it. But at the other, he's also saying he wants a compassionate answer. He wants a humane answer. Mm-hmm. And today, he suggested that he wants to work with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to get that done. If you're saying you want to work with Democrats, you by nature have to be open to a path to citizenship for these kids.
Right.
Or now, I should say we call them kids, but if they're DACA recipients, they tend to now be mainly in their mid-20s, though they were brought here as children.
Right. So Susan, this is really fascinating because you're bound up in this story about America's struggle with immigration reform is this transformation of the GOP as well.
Yeah.
And so I want to play a tape that will truly feel like a blast from the past. This is President George W. Bush advocating for comprehensive immigration reform to a group of business leaders back in 2007.
Our soul is constantly renewed. Our spirit is invigorated when people come here and realize the blessings of America. And so the bill that we've worked hard to craft is an important piece of legislation that addresses the needs of a failed system that says we're going to change for the better.
So that's President George W. Bush in 2007 talking about that version of immigration reform. But there was even some pushback then, right? There was concern over reform being equal to amnesty from some quarters.
Right. And I think anything that they decide to do on immigration, whether it has a path to a legal status or citizenship or some kind of clarity, by immigration hardliners, that will always be seen as amnesty. For many elements of the Republican Party, there is just no answer beyond deportation or go home and get back in line or enforce the law first, or we can't do anything until we can completely secure the borders. That used to be more of a minority view in the Republican Party. I think as you can hear from sort of the George W. Bush era, when he was president, he supported more comprehensive immigration. Even if you recall after the 2012 election when the Republican Party did the autopsy on why they lost.
Right, right.
And one of those conclusions was the party had to take a more expansive view about immigration legislation to not discourage Latino Americans from feeling like they could belong in the Republican Party. Now, this is the part about politics where it's an art and not a science, is that Donald Trump won the presidential election by kind of rejecting all of those lessons. So, you know, the past, there's never really been, as I said, there's been these moments where the stars seem to align and then some kind of political element happens that shakes it. And now we're back where things start to be aligning. Whether they can deliver this time, it's too hard to predict. But I would say there is bipartisan support for the DREAM Act. That's one of the things that's so wacky about this, is that they probably have the votes for it in Congress. They just might not want to pass it the way it needs to be passed, which is a Republican majority-controlled Congress essentially handing over the floor to Democrats and letting them lead the way to pass legislation with a minority of Republican support. That isn't generally how any party likes to run their majorities, is by letting the minority have the say. The thing is that depends on what the president wants.
Right.
You know, what does he want? And while he has called on Congress to act, he hasn't really told them what he will sign or won't sign. What does he want?
So,
and until we get an answer to that question, I think it's going to be hard to say for sure.
Susan, so many questions. This is so fascinating to me. But so about the DREAM Act specifically, though, I mean, last time that was up before Congress, at least if I remember correctly, on the House side, even though there's bipartisan support for it as a concept, it didn't pass, right? I mean, like there was political pushback against it. So I'm just curious about, maybe the answer is we don't know, but like what's ostensibly different this time around?
Well, you know, and there was also another attempt in 2010, and it did pass the House when Democrats were in control, and it failed in the Senate when Democrats were in control. So there is no party that hasn't had some element of blame for the failure of this legislation. In 2010, when it failed, it was because a number of Senate Democrats in Republican-leaning states who were heading into the 2010 midterms, where they could feel that their voters were not happy with immigration legislation, voted against it. Four of those five Democrats aren't in the Senate anymore. So the math has changed. I think the political calculus has changed. And I think part of the political calculus for acting now is Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell look at this issue and think, hey, do we want to deal with this now, or do we want to have this sort of immigration cliff in March of 2018 in the spring of a midterm election year?
So can I just jump in here for a second? Because I want to ask you about that, because you touched on it earlier, that there's also this deeper question about the Republican Party as a whole and sort of where it stands regarding the growing Latino electorate, right?
Yeah.
Because back in 2004, according to some numbers from ProPublica, President George W. Bush in 2004 won 44% of Latino voters. By 2012, Governor Romney won just 27% of the Hispanic vote. And of course, you know, whether or not President Trump right now is showing some flexibility on DACA specifically, during the campaign, he ran on, rhetoric that was, you know, very anti-immigration, you know, talking about immigrants as bad hombres, that kind of thing. So we have the president on one side, and then we have congressional Republicans on the other. I'm wondering, no matter what the president says now about DACA, I'm not seeing any signs that the same immigration hardliners in the Republican Party in Congress have changed their view at all. And they're the ones holding all the cards, right?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
You know, they. I don't know if you're going to change the minds of Republicans like Steve King of Iowa, who's a very prominent immigration hardliner in the Congress. But remember, you know, Paul Ryan, for example, is the Speaker of the House. In the past, he's been of the view that comprehensive immigration reform is a good thing. If done right, if they can get concessions that make Republicans happy, that there is a path forward. He has said that this is a job for Congress to fix, that it's a legislative problem. So I think the interest is there. I think people like Paul Ryan and leaders on Capitol Hill have to balance the long-term health of the Republican Party and its standing among various elements of the electorate and the base.
Mm-hmm.
And the party base right now has a pretty virulent skepticism of comprehensive immigration legislation, or of any immigration legislation, to be frank. But I think that people who take the long view in politics, who care about the party, who want to protect the party, who want Hispanic Americans to feel like they can be an active member of the Republican Party, that there's a home for them there, and they're trying to find a way to do that. I will not in any way underestimate that the politics are much harder for Republicans than it is for Democrats, especially if you're Democrats and you're looking at the midterms and you want Hispanic Americans to show up and vote. President Trump is giving them a lot of reasons to feel motivated to show up next year and cast a ballot.
So could that possibly be reason to hope, ironically, that some action in Congress could take place on this in the next 6 months?
It certainly could. And that's what I'm saying, where I think that they have to make the calculation. Is it better to pass a bill that might make your base angry but take the issue away as sort of your political bludgeon? Or is the base too strong and you don't have the votes that you're just going to have to fight it out in the spring and let the chips fall where they may? I don't think they know that yet. You know, the president kind of sprung this on Congress. There wasn't a long buildup or a lot of warning to say he was going to do it. I think they're still kind of assessing where their members are and what's possible. Democrats are saying they want to do it now. Some are saying they want to do it as early as this month. Mm. That seems a little ambitious. But if you want to inoculate the issue, if you want to take the Dreamer issue off the table, sometimes the political calculation is just to do it and get it over with. Because, you know, if they pass the Dream Act, the legislation this year, the story about the confrontation of it goes away, right?
Right.
And
right.
Politics are weird. I mean, it is not inconceivable that President Donald Trump, who campaigned as a very different Republican, could be a Republican president who signs the Dream Act, which creates a pathway to citizenship for certain elements of people in the country, into law. I mean, that would be a remarkable moment in both in policy and history and in politics. But I just feel like normal rules don't always apply
right.
when we're talking about the Trump administration and how he's dealing with Congress.
We are living in exceptional times.
We are living in exceptional times.
Susan Davis, congressional reporter for NPR. This has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for walking us through America's fraught recent history with immigration reform. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right. Well, Susan mentioned House Speaker Paul Ryan and his views on DACA. Speaker Ryan actually had something to say about it just this morning. Here he is.
President Trump was right in his decision. He made the right call. I'm also encouraged by the fact that he gave us time to work out a consensus, to find a compromise, because these kids don't, for the most part, don't know any other home than the United States. So I think the president was right to give us the time we need to find that compromise.
Well, joining us now is another congressional voice, Congresswoman Catherine Clark. She represents Massachusetts' 5th District. Representative Clark, it's good to have you back.
Oh, thank you for having me, Meghna.
So do you feel even an iota of hope that we could have some congressional legislation on immigration or at least on DACA sometime soon?
I have to agree with Susan. I think there is a chance. And I think that the political calculation has changed since this came up in Congress before. And that is due to the Dreamers themselves. This issue is never going to come or be solved by politicians, but these are brave young people who've come forward, told their stories at great personal jeopardy, and they've changed the minds of Americans on who they are and how they contribute and how they are Americans in every single way except for a paper trail.
Mm-hmm. Well, you heard in that tape, you heard Speaker Ryan talk about having the time to find a compromise. I mean, what do you think a potentially workable compromise might look like?
Well, first I have to say that I completely disagree with Speaker Ryan that the president was right. What the president has done here is really unspeakable cruelty. He has put 800,000 people into terror that they may be deported. We had a Department of Justice official yesterday tell Dreamers that they should get their affairs in order. So to somehow say, well, this is really a great opening to coming to an agreement on this is really despicable. But that being said, I think that the DREAM Act is bipartisan, bicameral legislation that is going to be before us. And I think there is going to be great pressure on House Republicans and, more importantly, on House leadership to get this done.
Right.
They do not want this to be an issue for them in the midterm election.
Yeah, so let me just jump in here, Representative, if I could, because you mentioned the DREAM Act, and that is co-sponsored by Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina on the Senate side. And Senator Dick Durbin spoke about this just yesterday in a press conference with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
It was 16 years ago when I introduced the DREAM Act, 16 years ago when the notion that these young people who were brought to the United States as toddlers and infants and children deserved an opportunity to make their way in America and prove themselves, and that that law was going to give them a chance. 16 years that we've been working on this project.
Representative Clark, you can almost hear the weariness in Senator Durbin's voice there. But do you feel, I mean, is this what you were getting to a little earlier, that perhaps of all the pending immigration legislation on the Hill, that the DREAM Act may be the one that's most likely to get over the line?
I do, because it does have broad bipartisan support, both in the House and the Senate. So I think if you put it up for a vote today on the floor of the House, it would pass. But what we have to do is get leadership to let that vote happen. And I think that by the president and the attorney general's horrific change of course that they set forth yesterday and the effect on families, you know, these are families in our neighborhoods. These are families in our communities. They are part of our economy. And this is just a punitive, cruel proposal. Mm. And I think that there are many Republicans who wish that they did not undertake this callous move against kids who were brought here, their innocence in this, and they have become true Americans
right.
in every single way. Today we had a press conference again, and there were dreamers down here who are business owners and law students, and you know, a group of them up from Arkansas are fasting over by the Library of Congress. This has put lives and people into turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And for what?
Well,
to make these innocent people a victim of this president's politics and pandering to a very small, very mean-spirited part of his base.
So Representative Clark, I mean, some might say that the president has shown a certain degree of perhaps ideological flexibility on this, because just last night, I'm sure as you know, the president tweeted that Congress has 6 months to pass some kind of immigration reform, and that if it doesn't, he will revisit it. And just this afternoon on Air Force One, he seemed to sort of repeat that idea. Here he is.
Congress, I really believe, wants to take care of the situation. I really believe it. Even very conservative members of Congress, I've seen it firsthand. If they don't, we're going to see what we're going to do.
Well, and Representative, as Susan Davis was telling us earlier, maybe is that just enough wiggle room to get more recalcitrant members of Congress on board? Is there a possibility here?
I think it's very difficult with this president, who treats the truth as something that is transactional, to understand where he's coming from. But we have to stop trying to find some other meaning and look at his actions. He did a very cowardly thing yesterday. He threw people's lives into turmoil, and he didn't even come out and do it himself. Instead, he passed the buck to an attorney general who was part of the obstruction of this legislation in Congress. And the irony to have Jeff Sessions coming out and saying, well, now it's up for Congress to do their job with this president. It's just, you know, it really is just too much.
Right. So final question to you, Congresswoman. I mean, this is obviously a deeply important, deeply emotional, moral question even for America right now. But is it also an opportunity for Democrats? Could they potentially show political leadership here by extending their hand across the aisle and saying, we will work with you. We will be good faith partners in arriving at some sort of immigration reform, some sort of compromise that helps as many people as possible, so that they're not painted by the Republicans as being the party that's stopping something from happening in the next 6 months?
Well, I think that we have been waiting patiently with hand extended across the aisle on immigration. And I think what you're going to see from the Democrats is that the DREAM Act is a bipartisan bill.
Mm-hmm.
It is not everything I would certainly want, but it is a bipartisan bill, and that's important on this issue. And so I think what you're going to see is the Democratic Party and the Democrats in Congress showing spine and saying that we are not going to tolerate this abuse of innocent families and innocent children who were brought to this country and who have become Americans in every true sense.
Yeah.
And that we are going to insist that they take care of them.
Well, Catherine Clark is representative. She's a congresswoman representing the Massachusetts 5th District. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Representative Clark. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Apple Watch Gate. That's what I'm going to call it. Hashtag that, everybody. It's Wednesday. Time for sports. And joining us to talk about it is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
Also with us is WBR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hi there, Shira.
Hello. So, I'm liking iGate, though.
iGate?
iGate. Oh, that's what I've been hearing.
Fewer characters, better
yes.
for Twitter. But I don't know.
Yes.
I like Apple Watch Gate. So guys, what happened? What's going on here with the Sox and
it's
cheating
just another,
again?
It's another chapter in the ongoing saga of Boston professional sports teams cheating. They cheat.
Said the pessimist.
They cheat and they win, and that's how you win. You cheat.
You guys are like my little like good angel, bad angel on my shoulders right now. And so what does the optimist say, Shira?
Well, I say this is another example of a Boston team looking for a competitive edge and maybe
cheating.
pushing the envelope way too far into the illegal realm.
Oh, wait, too far into the illegal? Shouldn't like even a hair into the illegal be enough for it to be illegal?
Yeah, well, you know,
but
sign
if you're
going to
do it, just go all the way. You know?
Sign stealing is not illegal as long as you do it in the way that they were doing it in the late 1800s and early 1900s, which is
and all the way up to like
peering,
the 1950s and 60s
in the
and 70s.
60s and yeah, as long as you're sort of peering around the side of the catcher and seeing how many fingers he's putting down for the pitcher, that's all right.
Okay.
But once you're using electronics in the dugout, that's when you allegedly cross the line. This is all, by the way, something that I've learned in the last 20 minutes.
I know, me too, actually. Crack staff has found, like,
right.
What, back in 2000, there was a rule put out saying electronic devices cannot be used to steal signs.
Yeah, well, because you don't want to start sort of an electronic arms race with this. You don't, I mean, sort of like NASCAR, where the best technology wins. I think the commissioner's office is worried.
The Red Sox have a bad setup. That's NASCAR talk.
Yeah.
So they cheated.
But it's sort of like when, you know, you're worried about the best team with the best technology doing more and more and more and more to kind of gain advantages in more and more subtle ways. And I think that was the commissioner's office, the concern of the commissioner's office way back when they put the electronics rule in place.
Okay, can we just step back for a second? I just have to ask my sports Luddite question here. What exactly were they supposed to have done with the Apple Watch to steal the signs
so
from the
is,
Yankees? I don't get it.
So this is like unbelievably convoluted when you actually spell it out. So you have basically somebody who's in the clubhouse looking at replay video so that they can tell the manager, John Farrell, like, hey, you might want to challenge.
Wait a minute, John Farrell says he didn't know a thing.
Well, this is for the replay situation. So this is for the legit situation here.
Okay.
So, hey, you might want to challenge this play on the field. The umpire may have made the wrong call here. But apparently this person in the clubhouse was also looking at signals and then relaying information about those signals
to
an assistant trainer with an Apple Watch in the dugout, who was then somehow relaying that information to players in the dugout, who would then relay that information to the Red Sox base runners, who would then relay that information to the Red Sox batter. And now you wonder why Major League Baseball games take so long to play.
But by which time the batter would have struck out looking. Because he'd be waiting
for the signal. Or stepped out of the batter's box about like six or seven
but
times.
There's an important thing that so far I haven't seen anybody write about with respect to this alleged. It's not alleged anymore because the Red Sox have acknowledged
it.
Okay. With this incident. You know how hard it is to hit a major league pitch? I mean, most major league hitters,
it's hard
they
to
get
hit a
up
pitch
there,
in a batting
and if
cage.
The pitcher were to say to them, here comes the outside curveball, they might hit it and they might not. You know, hey, here comes the high, tight fastball. They might. They might not. It's not that easy.
Are you saying it doesn't make a difference?
No, it probably does make a difference, but it's a marginal difference.
I don't know how marginal, because they did do some statistics from when the Red Sox played the Yankees and when this was in place. And I believe when the Red Sox had a runner on second and this whole relay scheme was in place with the Apple Watch, the Red Sox went the batters went 5 for 8.
Yeah, but another time they went 1 for 3 and another time. And I'm not convinced that it was enormously useful. I mean,
I think it can be useful in key situations.
I'm still stuck in how the use of high-tech equipment turned into a giant game of telephone to relaying the signals. But
or charades. It seems more like charades.
Or something.
No, if it was telephone, it would have started out fastball coming and ended up curveball coming, and it would have in fact been counterproductive.
Do we know that didn't actually happen?
Well,
no,
yes,
we don't.
Because Shira has just given us the statistics, which I will not argue with because she knows more about this than I do.
We have to move on to tennis, but there's one more thing about the Sox that I want to ask, and we're just going to borrow this from Steve Buckley at the Herald, because really, the nation sort of gleefully heard this news because it was, you know, yet more reason to hate the Red Sox, I guess. And again, Buckley at the Herald says it's in line with the character of the team. He wrote, "It stands to reason that a team so lacking in soul and decorum would then stoop to using electronics to steal signs."
Yeah, he was basing that in part, at least, on David Price's going off on Dennis Eckersley, a broadcaster, also Hall of Fame pitcher, who said some things about Price and about some of his teammates that were entirely appropriate, because the job of a broadcaster to say, wow, that guy's been 0 for 20 the last couple of weeks. And he went off on Eckersley and called him all sorts of names and said he hadn't been around the clubhouse. And so I think Buckley has moved from that to saying these guys are lacking in character.
So apples and oranges, maybe?
Well, I'm not sure they're any more full of character or lacking in character than lots of other baseball teams.
Period.
I'm still disappointed that it wasn't like the internal gyroscope of the Apple Watch that helped them figure out what the signals were.
You mean you wanted it more complicated than it actually was?
This is
was?
The greatest thing that ever happened to the Apple Watch.
Well,
wasn't that a bomb? I mean, wasn't that a product that nobody bought for a long time?
There was a headline somewhere that someone finally
perfect
found a use
case.
For the Apple Watch.
That was a Slate headline,
Now, every major league team will have dozens of them arriving by FedEx the next time we turn around.
I want to move on to what we can call a sort of undisputed accomplishment, and that's Venus Williams, because she won a huge match last night in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open. So let's talk about, tell me about how great Venus's match was last night, Bill.
Well, I think it's great and remarkable for a number of reasons. One is this is a woman who her career seemed to be over. Not so long ago, she had this autoimmune condition. She was not well and was having a hard time getting by. And now all of a sudden, she's in the semifinals of the U.S. Open. So that's exciting. Also, she's 37 years old, which for a tennis player is pretty well along.
It's ancient.
Beyond that, I think the only explanation is she's very excited about being an aunt.
Oh, yeah.
because her somewhat more accomplished tennis-playing sister has had a baby. So that's exciting, too.
And news for the Williams is all around.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's also nice because I think for so long, it's not exactly that Venus Williams was in the shadow of Serena Williams, but she kind of, I mean, her sister was number one. Her sister was setting all the records. And it's nice to see and be able to recognize just what an outstanding talent. I mean, if not for Serena, Venus Williams would be in the history-making, record-setting business.
Exactly.
And oh, also, she's in there anyway.
She is in there anyway, but she would be more so if not for her sister. And it was also a great match. The drama was because her opponent, Petra Kvitova, if I can say that correctly.
So notice how I didn't try.
was coming back from being brutally attacked in a home invasion where she was stabbed in her racket hand. So this was marked the comeback from her from kind of all sorts of adversity, too. You know, she can't even grip a tennis racket with full strength.
Really?
Still? Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So, I mean, tennis has some great stories, some great drama out there.
I was just going to say, and you know, Venus Williams was so gracious after the match, saying she didn't want to let the crowd down and things like that. And overall, my takeaway thought is women's tennis continues to be one of the most exciting, interesting sports anywhere.
Compelling drama. Every match.
Yeah. Well, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, thank you so much.
Pleasure as always.
And I'm with you. Even a toe over the line is cheating. Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Thank you, Shira.
Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Remember this moment from the very first episode of Comedy Central's Colbert Report back in 2005?
Anybody who knows me know that I'm no fan of dictionaries or reference books. They're elitist. Constantly telling us what is or isn't true or what did or didn't happen. Who's Britannica to tell me the Panama Canal was finished in 1914? If I want to say it happened in 1941, that's my right. I don't trust books. They're all fact, no heart.
And thus entered the era of truthiness. But of course, Colbert's character on the show was fictional, but that sentiment taps into something Kurt Anderson says has been eating away at the core of America and American life for some 500 years, even older than the nation itself. We've slowly become untethered from reality, Anderson says. And he says that long history has inevitably led the United States to President Donald Trump. Kurt Anderson is a novelist, cultural critic, host of the public radio show Studio 360, and a best-selling author. His new book is Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. And he joins us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Kurt Anderson, welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure to be here.
I'm going to stumble here a little bit because your indictment of America's relationship with the truth is truly all-encompassing. And at times it sort of gave me pause. But I wonder if you could actually just read a little bit from the book, a paragraph from early on page 11, where you say how much America has always had this strange relationship with truth.
I will. And I just want to say, first of all, that I wouldn't call it an indictment.
No?
And nor would I say it's eaten away. It's ultimately eaten away at our core, but it is at our core, is my point. It's always been here, and it's gotten out of control. But we'll talk about that. The passage you'd like me to read is, America was created by true believers and passionate dreamers, by hucksters and their suckers, which over the course of four centuries has made us susceptible to fantasy, as epitomized by everything from Salem hunting witches to Joseph Smith creating Mormonism, from P.T. Barnum to Henry David Thoreau to speaking in tongues, from Hollywood to Scientology to conspiracy theories, from Walt Disney to Billy Graham to Ronald Reagan to Oprah Winfrey to Donald Trump. In other words, mix epic individualism with extreme religion, mix show business with everything else, let all that steep and simmer for a few centuries, run it through the anything-goes 1960s and the Internet age, the result is the America we inhabit today, where reality and fantasy are weirdly and dangerously blurred and commingled.
Hmm. So why is that not an indictment of America?
Well, it wasn't always so bad. It worked for
right.
a while. All of these predilections and parts of the American character, this extreme individualism, this extreme anti-establishment feeling that sometimes became anti-intellectualism as well, embrace of every form of entertaining fiction, some of them in the form of entertainment, others not, the P.T. Barnums of the world, all this, Disneyland, all of it has, there has been, some of it's good, some of it's not so bad. All of it was contained. All of it was kept in a kind of dynamic balance by the reality-checking gatekeepers and establishments. And it worked okay, and we dreamed the impossible dream, and we thought big, and we did the impossible because the prudent countervailing forces and opinions were in control.
Yeah.
And then over the last, in my history, 50 years, that control diminished until we got to the point of the last, especially, 20 years or so, where preposterous beliefs of real consequence in society became mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem. I mean, when people are just having nutty beliefs and practices on their own, I don't have a real problem with that.
The problem is that it can wash over on the rest of us now.
Correct.
But so I do want to spend some time going through your analysis of the 1960s in particular. But before we do that, just as in a nod to the deep history here that you write about, I mean, you talk about early in the book about John Winthrop, obviously a familiar figure here in the Boston area, that Puritan man who gave us the vision of the city on the hill.
Yeah.
But you point out that a couple lines later in that same speech, he goes off and warns about the end of days.
Well, no, the Puritans believed that the end time and the return of Jesus and the end of the world, Armageddon, was imminent, as well as believing that there were witches in their midst, which became a problem almost a century after they arrived in your Commonwealth. and created it. No, they were a nutty religious cult. They were who came here came to Massachusetts and Boston and created a theocracy. Then when somebody even nuttier than they in their midst, Anne Hutchinson, rose up and started her own kind of quasi-church where she thought she could tell who was going to heaven and she was godlier than them and she spoke directly to God, well, that was too much for them and they banished her. So those were our founders, a small f, not the people who started the United States, who, of course, were Enlightenment people who rejected that kind of religion. So that's where we started.
Mm. You know, you go from that, and then again, you do a very careful analysis of the long period of time between that and the 1960s. But I do think that your take on the 60s is obviously key here. And it's a take on that generation that I personally hadn't really thought about before, that was when we begin to see, in your mind, in your eyes, the decoupling or the legitimization of the decoupling of truth from our daily lives.
Well, and again, truth sounds metaphysical and existential. I'm really talking about the factual
fact,
shape of empirical reality.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, of course, and those of us older than you who were at least children in the 60s and experienced it and who are some in some general sense leftish think, oh, the 60s were great. The 60s were nothing but good. Civil rights, the environmental concern, the beginnings of feminism, gay rights. Oh, it was great. Anti-war. But what is lost in that and the sex, drugs, rock and roll fun parts of the 1960s, I think I found as I began thinking about this and how did this come to be, was exactly as you say, this rise of anti-science and even anti-reason and anti-rationality.
But what was going on in the 60s that drove that?
Well, it was part. Well, we had a war going on, certainly, that was all supposed to be the most rational thing ever accomplished by the then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and rationalism got a bad name, and in general, in ways I sketch out but are familiar to most Americans, the kind of countercultural upsurge of like, hey, everything's up for grabs, nothing that we believe before is necessarily true, including both in the popular culture, but also in campuses and in the academy, this challenge of Western reason and of empiricism. And, the magical ways of thinking and religious explanations for things and are just as valid as our science and our reason. That became a way that we were supposed to think. And we could no longer, it was uncool and impolitic to say no. We believe in science, for instance, and so that had some, a couple of generations to scale out and become part of the popular American understanding of things. At the same time, I mean, the 60s also was the time when Protestantism, when Christian Protestantism in America and kind of only in America in the developed world became as extreme as it had been, as it hadn't been since the 1600s, since Winthrop and the Puritans and Hutchinson.
So, Kurt, if I could just jump in here, because there's something that I couldn't quite figure out about this sort of fulcrum around the 1960s. And that, to a certain degree, it made a lot of sense to me that, yes, the Vietnam War, the catastrophe of that, and then also the rise of this idea of relativism or grappling with the truth about, the damage that the powers that be had wrought around the world through colonialism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all these things actually make sense to me. These were issues and ways of constructing our society that deserved pushback.
Sure.
But how did that tip over from that into what you call, like, very clearly, like the pandering to the vanity and self-righteousness of the new youth that led to, like, the rejection of science?
Well, there were two parts of the 60s, really. There was the strictly political side. The things you just described, let's be anti-war, let's be honest about American imperialism, whatever. The strictly political, more or less rational parts of the critique, the 60s critique. Then there was this whole other countercultural thing that was aligned with that, but was really about, no, we are mystical. We can divine things. The shamans from wherever are as valid as our professors or our scientists. That whole thing was linked to the political 60s, but was a separate thing. And it's out of that second part, the hippie part, if you will, the countercultural part, as opposed to the new left part, the political part, that was where the headwaters of New Age and all the rest and essentially alternative facts was.
Yeah. You know, it makes me wonder. So then we have the 60s and 70s and 80s, and we get into a period of cable television and then the internet, which we could talk forever about in terms of how that amplified any theory or any idea of what constitutes fact. But I keep thinking back to, you know, the founding myth of the United States as a whole, right? This place where this inviolable myth that you can accomplish anything, you can do anything, anyone can be anyone. Mm-hmm. In a way, isn't where we find ourselves today somewhat inevitable? Like, as you write, we Americans feel newly entitled to believe absolutely anything.
And to treat, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan famously said, people are entitled to their own opinions. They're not entitled to their own facts. Well, now they are. And now the people who work for the presidents come out and say, no, those are our alternative facts. So I don't know about inevitable. History is never inevitable. But looking back and year by year and decade by decade and century by century at these things I've looked at for the last few hundred years, we were inclined in this direction, and yes, the seeds were always there. So Donald Trump and alternative facts and post-truth and all these new startling things and this new startling situation didn't come out of 2015. It's been in our bloodstream, and like as in certain medical conditions. It suddenly kind of metastasized out of control in the last couple of decades.
Well, the fact that it has been in our bloodstream, I think that's the thing that I come away from your book feeling an even greater sense of alarm and concern. Because if it has been in our bloodstream for so long and just recently metastasized, doesn't that feel like it makes it that much harder to regain or reclaim the centrality of the notion that we should all adhere to a certain factual reality?
Yeah, it does. Now, again, if we want to carry the illness metaphor, things go into remission, and just because it's there doesn't mean we have to let it proceed uncontrolled. Now, you mentioned the internet, and I talk a lot about the effects of the internet on this phenomenon, that makes it hard. It does. It really makes it hard to put this genie back in the lamp or the toothpaste back in the tube. So I don't think we are just gonna, we're gonna get over this and John Kasich will become president and everything will be okay. See, because Donald Trump is not the cause. Donald Trump is a symptom, and if he hadn't been elected president, what I am describing in every respect except his election as president would still be true. So we are this thing. We are these people who have blurred fantasy and reality to an exceptional and in some cases dangerous degree. And so it's up to we reality-based few to put our stakes in the ground when friends or children or family or whomever to say nutty, insupportable, untrue things, instead of saying, yeah, whatever, I think we have to say, no, that's not true, and stand up for it. I think we can – I am hopeful that we can prevent fantasy land from expanding its grip. Yeah. I don't think we can roll it back, but I think we can say, okay, we're at peak fantasy land. Let's where we live, what we do. If we're in the public sphere, so much better. We can do what we we can do what we can in that realm. But let's not let this slide any further. Let's not, for instance, if we run a cable TV channel, put on more so-called documentaries about mermaids existing, as an example.
Right. Or the alien chasers or the paranormal shows
all
that
those.
Yeah, pop up on my Netflix queue. We've just got a minute to go, Kurt, and I hate ending on a pessimistic note, but I have to read one line that you wrote. You say, "I really can't imagine for the first time in my life that America has permanently tipped into irreversible decline, heading deeper into fantasy land."
Yeah.
Again, you just said that perhaps we can dial it back a little bit, but is that really ultimately your long view here?
I don't end with a rousing three cheers. This is temporary. It may be, and. But I am a hopeful person. I am an optimist. I am an American. But as I say, it's hard for me, after looking at this history and seeing what our predilections are, to think like, no, it'll all be good.
Right.
Just give us a little time. It might be, but it's not going to happen without a struggle.
Well, you also, yes, you remind us all to continue to fight the good fight when it comes to clinging to reality. Kurt Anderson, his new book is Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. He is the host of the fabulous public radio show, Studio 360. What a pleasure to speak with you, Kurt. Thanks so much.
Thank you, man.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.